For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
You are over us. And that means that we have to humble ourselves, but this is so baked into us, we don't really understand how far it goes. We pray that your Spirit would be the one who reveals, who shows us our need to shrink, to become creaturely, to trust you with our lives and to love others. Amen. Well, this slide is the whole workshop. So I'm just going to sit here until you give up your entitlement. We're going to anchor everything in 1 Peter 5:5-6. All of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. And from this, I think we can take, oddly enough, 4 points. One is that you're proud. There's never a command without a violation. And frankly, it'd be hard to find any page in the Bible that doesn't address the issue of our pride. It doesn't manifest often as pride itself, arrogance, boasting. It manifests itself in failing to trust God, failing to care for others. But you are proud. I'm going to spend a little bit of time with this point. Secondly, since you need to humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, humble yourselves toward God. Thirdly, humble yourselves toward others. And then lastly, God will oppose the proud and exalt the humble. I'm always glad to hear that he's going to oppose the proud when I look at politicians. But I not so much when I look in the mirror. Thanks. I have a responsive audience. You're awesome. So these are going to be our points. And let's go ahead and dig in. You're proud. I like what Lewis said. He said, the first step in acquiring humility is to realize you're proud. Until you realize this, nothing can be done about it. Which is why I'm kind of lingering with this first point a little bit. So I ask you to take a humility assessment. If you haven't, just look it over. You just circle the ones that really pop for you and seem really true. I'm not going to give you a huge amount of time here because we've got a seminar to work on. But I want you to sort of get a sense of where you're at. So what do you notice as you're looking through this? Maybe you're not all the way through it. I just collected these questions from various people who were talking about pride in their own life. And a lot of them resonate with me. For instance, I often wonder if someone's going to mention my name in a meeting. That's why I included that one. When I'm wrong, it's all I can think about. I'm pretty defensive in conflict, but only because I'm being attacked. So that's a defense, you know, in the question itself is a defense. I tend to zoom in on what I disagree with and other people talk. A real popular pride indicator here in our fellowship is I'm a man pleaser. But that implies something, doesn't it? You're not a God pleaser, which means you're unfaithful to God. That's pride. Well, what did you notice in your own self-assessment? I'm making you stop now. What did you notice? Part of unpacking this is to see how the things you feel like you wrestle with are ultimately tied to pride, as I think are all sins. No one's harder on me than me. No one thinks about me more than me, right? Let's take a look at this. Pride, I think, is the mother of all sins. When we go to Genesis and we look at the serpent's temptation of Eve, what do we notice? After he dialogues with her a little while, what do you notice about her? She looks at the fruit. She sees it's good to eat and that it's desirable for making one wise. So she's doing all of this really scientific work. I don't know how she knew it was good to eat. Maybe a bear came wandering by and grabbed a chunk. Who knows? Bears can eat a lot of things humans can eat. I don't know how she figured it out, but you know what's missing? God's assessment's missing. His command not to eat is missing. His explanation, the day you eat it, that you will die, is missing. What's missing, and so what's present, is pride. She's decided to take on herself the decision about whether to eat this fruit or not. If we look at Romans chapter 1, verse 21, when the author Paul begins to explain the cause of human sin, he says that when people looked at the creation, though they knew it implied a creator, they neither thanked him nor worshiped him, but their heart, their minds became evil and twisted. And there's a whole line of sins that follow from hubris, pride. But humility, I think, too, is the mother of all virtues. If we read, I'm going to read this guy named von Hildebrand. He said, humility is the precondition and the basic presupposition for the genuineness, the beauty, and the truth of all virtue. Pride is not only by itself our primal sin, it also inwardly contaminates all intrinsically good dispositions and robs every virtue of its value before God. So even, I think as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, even if you have all these abilities and you do all of these things, if you lack love, it's worthless. I think that's the point that he's making. Even good things get robbed of their value because of pride. So if we read Psalm 25:9, we read that God leads the humble in justice and teaches the humble his way, the mother of all virtues. Who learns God's way? The humble learn God's way. And again, in Proverbs 11:2, when pride comes, then comes dishonor. But with the humble is wisdom. So let's take a look at this. I'm going to essentially posit that pride is narcissistic and humility is realistic. So let's take a look at this. Biblical words about pride carry the idea, in Hebrew and Greek, carry the idea of self-elevation, puffing up, getting larger, that is, beyond your actual size. Where language about humility, biblical words carry the idea of shrinking. Since the Bible assumes we're proud, shrinking is toward your actual size. So I'm going to focus on a few areas with this idea of pride being narcissistic and humility being realistic. You could probably say much more about pride and humility. I'm going to land on three. One is focus. Pride is narcissistic in its focus. That is, the thing that's a real hallmark of pride is its inordinate focus on self. True humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. And so his point is that if you have a mind that's constantly turning over yourself, how you are relative to people, what it is you want, what it is you're hoping for, if you find that nearly every thought is about you, this is pride. Inordinate focus on self. Lewis says in his collected letters, during my afternoon meditations, I found out ludicrous and terrible things about my own character. Will you believe it? One out of every three thoughts is a thought of self-admiration. I catch myself posturing before the mirror, so to speak, all day long. I pretend I'm carefully thinking out loud what to say to the next pupil, for his good, of course, and then suddenly I realize I'm thinking how frightfully clever I'm going to be and how he'll admire me. And then when you force yourself to stop it, you admire yourself for doing that. It's like fighting the Hydra. There seems to be no end to it. Depth under depth of self-love and self-admiration. This is certainly one form of pride. If you tend to have low self-esteem or deal with shame, I have bad news for you. That's another form of pride. Even negative self-attention is self-attention. So being self-critical is you thinking about yourself. It's the nature of pride to focus on self. I like what David Powlison, he just passed away this year, said in his book from Making All Things New. Sin turns you in on yourself, blinding you to God. Self-loathing exalts your opinion of yourself as supremely important. Shame exalts the opinion of other people. But what God chooses to remember about you is decisive. If your conscience is well-tuned, it's dependent on the stance he takes. See the difference between a proud person and a humble person? A proud person is confident in their self-evaluation, even if it's negative. You want to do an experiment sometime? If someone is cutting on themselves and critical of themselves and negative about themselves, say, I think you're right. A lot of times what you'll get is rage. Because there's this sort of thing that works in the shame community, which is this: no one's harder on me than I am. But if you agree, you're going to see rage. My wife and I ran to this one time with someone who had been immoral and was talking, using really rough language on herself. And my wife said, yes, this is really bad. It looked like she was going to jump out of her chair and kill my wife. She was happy to slay herself. She wasn't happy to be agreed with. Read the paper on morbid introspection at your leisure. Sometimes in talks like this, some people, they say, this is just morbid introspection. We shouldn't think about ourselves. And I agree, but I think there's a big difference between morbid introspection, which is at its core prideful. Morbid introspection wants to have omniscience about itself, and morbid introspection wants to be righteous. If anything, they're sad they're not self-righteous. They wish they could be, right? This isn't this pride. Pride is narcissistic, and it's inordinate self-attention. It usually shows up through comparison and competition with other people. A lot of our strongest drives are to compete and compare. And again, Lewis, in his chapter of The Great Sin in Mere Christianity, says, now what you want to get clear is the pride is essentially competitive. It's competitive by its very nature. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They're proud of being richer, cleverer, better looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good looking, there'd be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. Once the element of competition is gone, pride has gone. I think this is it's good insight. A lot of times what schools will do is they'll give kids uniforms so that all the children won't show up and compete in the fashion that they wear. But what happens is the richer kids start accessorizing their uniform so they're better, right? It's just the nature of human beings. Humility, however, is realistic in that it focuses on God as an important feature. Really, a God focus, you have to be humble to focus on God, and you focus on God it humbles you. Psalm 115:1 says, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name be the glory, because your loving kindness, because of your truth. This Bible word glory is an important one to keep your eyes peeled for. Glory means to be given a sense of weight. Significance might be a word that we would use in our culture. And God deserves the significance. He deserves the weight. Not to us. We don't deserve the glory. You deserve the glory. But when we look at the way we behave toward others, a lot of times we're always seeking glory. Most of the porn industry is driven by a desire for sexualized glory. To be admired, to be desired, to be appreciated in a fantasy. That's sexual worship. It's a hunger for glory. See how pride is the mother of all sin. Look at Psalm 37. Here's some excerpts from it. Delight yourself in the Lord. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him. Rest in the Lord. Wait patiently for Him. The humble will inherit the land. Who are the humble? The ones who do this. Who delight in the Lord. Who commit your behavior to the Lord. Who trust in the Lord. Who rest in Him and wait patiently for Him. That's who the humble are. Humility is the mother of all virtues. Pride is narcissistic also about what it knows. This was sort of my entry point into thinking about humility years ago, as I began to wonder about errors human beings make and how they assess things. And so this will be a little bit longer. But pride is inordinately confident in what it knows. It believes it knows better and more than it actually does. So here's our sidebar. It's the little box in your notes. Let me give you first, this was kind of my entry point. I wish I could say the Bible was my entry point into thinking about this, but actually science was my entry point. We self-deceive and self-justify. Who says this? Science says this. You can see it in the book. Mistakes were made, but not by me. These are two social psychologists. They look at a lot of data, and the evidence of the data they look at is that human beings self-deceive so rapidly and self-justify in response to their own self-deception, they dare not trust their own conclusions. And one of the chief carriers of all of this is memory. That we create false memories where we're the hero. Or if we really do have negative self-esteem, we're the villain. And one guy, so there's this one expert on memory who has a recollection of his mom wanting him to go to University of Michigan so he could be close to home. But he wanted to go to Stanford where he could get his degree. And he felt very heroic for this. He was barely aware he felt heroic. Years later, he was going through a box of correspondence. People used to connect with each other through paper. And he was going through that box of correspondence, and she wanted him to go to Stanford. He wanted to go to the University of Michigan. He totally misremembered the whole thing. And he says the best way to keep a memory intact is to never remember it. Because in remembering, the part of our brain that's involved in distributing memory to different parts of the brain is also the part that's involved in imagination. And when you recall a memory and this part stitches things together, it always puts you in a good light. Now, someone who's done a lot of marriage counseling, let me tell you what a bad marriage looks like. Two people recalling the same event with totally different details. We were in the backyard. We weren't in the backyard. We were in the living room. You said this. I never said that. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. What about when you did that? I didn't do that. Let's grant for a second they're not liars. This is how memory actually works. That's how your memory actually works. So after I read this book, I got in a fight with my wife. And she said, you said this, and I said, I don't think I said that. She said, you did. And I thought, I read the book now. I can't go back and say I know for sure. I say, well, I don't think I did. If I did, that was bad. But I'm not sure. Well, I am. This is the nature of our memories. We self-deceive and we self-justify. I have never been in a fight where this wasn't what was driving the whole thing. There's a song I listened to when I was a young guy, by a singer named Roger Miller. It's called Husbands and Wives. And I thought it was profound even at the time, and I think it's more profound now. He's saying, and I'm not going to hurt your ears, he's saying, it's my belief pride is the chief cause of the decline in the number of husbands and wives. I agree. I totally agree. It is the chief cause in the dissolution of relationships of all kinds. Our brains make consistent and predictable errors. We have two brain areas. One brain area grinds very slowly, methodically. Think of being in math class or a formal logic class. It grinds very methodically through steps to come up at an answer. With an answer, this part of the brain requires a lot of energy. We can watch blood glucose levels dropping when someone's thinking and using this part of the brain. This part of the brain doesn't like to be used. It's lazy. It's good, but it's lazy. And so if 60% of men, if you ask them to be in a room by themselves and think for 15 minutes about vacation plans, for instance, they would rather give themselves a painful electrical shock than to sit quietly and think for 15 minutes. Women are a little less bad, but not that great either. And so there's another part of the brain, though, that requires very little energy. It's intuitive. It's, you know, the gut feelings we get, our emotions are tied up with this system. Very rapid, very often the logical part of our brain, when presented with our intuitions, will just go with what the intuition is because it doesn't want to work. Even statisticians, when given a statistical problem they could easily solve, make the wrong guess about the answer. If you don't hand them a pencil and paper and tell them to work it out, they'll guess wrong. Intuitive part of the brain is useful. I heard a story about a fire chief who was in a kitchen there putting out a kitchen fire, and he didn't even know why he yelled it, but he yelled, "Get out!" And they all fled the room, the floor collapsed. The fire was actually in the basement. He couldn't figure out why he yelled, "Get out." Later he's like, "Well, my ears were unusually hot." And the fire was pretty quiet. And just those little pieces of information stitched together to create a danger signal, and he yelled, "Get out," and saved. It's not like this part of the brain's terrible. It's just not reliable. It has to be checked. And these cognitive biases have been unpacked by Daniel Kahneman and his late colleague Amos Tversky, two Jewish self-taught psychologists, statisticians. They began noticing that human beings use rules of thumb. They call these heuristics. And they have certain biases that pop up in very predictable ways. And they use tests to test and bring these things forward. And they list all kinds of these cognitive biases. One that you probably are all familiar with is confirmation bias. Has anyone heard this? Has anyone not heard this? Confirmation bias is this. If you decide something is so, then you tend to notice evidence for your conclusion and you tend to ignore evidence against your conclusion. This is human nature. This is how your brain works. So that means what? In our fellowship, you know what's highly prized is discernment. You know what pride does with someone tells you you're discerning, you have good discernment. You know what pride does with that? It decides that everything that pops into your head is true because you have good discernment. Protect me from anyone telling me I have good discernment or wisdom. Thank God he's going to beat it out of me. Well, some of these cognitive biases are confirmation bias, availability. If you may have heard this before, so you're going to give the right answer, but who's more likely to be injured in the line of duty, a cop or an arborist? It depends on what news you've been watching. If you've been watching news where cops have been injured in various ways or hit by cars, you're going to say cops. That's what's available to your memory, and so that's what you pull forward. It's actually arborists. We don't often run across arborist death statistics, but they're higher than police death statistics. Affect heuristic. Here's a rule of thumb. If I feel good about you, I tend to think, and you want to be hired for the job, I tend to think of all the things that are good about you that would fit with this job because I feel good about you. And I tend to not notice all those things that maybe would be a bad fit for the job. This is really important when it comes to gossip. You know, confessing someone else's sins to someone else. You know, if you come to me and I think to myself, you are an unreliable source, and you say critical things to me about someone, even if I think you're unreliable, it'll bias me against the person you talk about. This is why receiving gossip and certainly transmitting gossip, but in allowing people to give gossip is really not good for you, it's not good for them, and it's not good for the person being talked about. Get in the habit of saying, whoa, have you talked with them about this? And do they know you're talking with me about this? Then don't talk with me about this. There's probably a time to get help and get some assistance in your thinking, but we use that cover a lot, and we affect how people view other people. Well, there's others as well. There's like 34 different cognitive biases. Yeah. So we have ways that we make errors. Selective attention. You ever see the gorilla movie where people are bouncing balls around and the observer is given the task of noticing how many times a certain team's ball gets passed back and forth? And they're watching the movie. And in the middle of the movie, a person in a gorilla suit walks past the camera, does this, and then walks off. 60% of the observers don't see the gorilla. That's why the fight happened in the backyard. No, it happened in the living room. Especially when we're under stress, like a fight, we stop noticing certain things and we focus on other things. There's more to say about that, but I won't. Memory formation and recall. I've already mentioned this, but the way memories are formed and recalled tends to benefit the rememberer. It's easy to form a false memory. They've done these experiments where they brought people in and said, hey, we've interviewed your parents. They told us about the time you had an appendectomy when you were in first grade and how you did this, and some details are added. And the person walks away who's never had an appendectomy with a memory that they had an appendectomy. This is why when you're interviewed by a police officer, if they say things like, how far was the car going when it bashed into you, they're going to get a different speed than to say, how fast was the car going when it bumped into you? Just the words used by the police officer will affect the answer you give. It's the nature of memory formation and recall. And by the way, marketing firms know all about this. You know, JCPenney had this thing they did for a while that was a colossal failure. They stopped issuing coupons. And they just went with everyday low pricing. They just took a beating. Why? Because the price you see on the sticker is an anchor. This is another bias, an anchoring bias. And so the discounts, like 30% off this, feels like a good deal. They use it all the time. Politicians use it all the time. Fire hosing you with false information leads you to believe the false information. Our development can distort our thinking and feeling as well. Just look up cognitive distortions on Google, and you'll see what therapists have to deal with, frankly, all the time, often for developmental reasons, like jumping to conclusions. Some of you get all of your exercise jumping to conclusions. You see this, you know what it means, and then you have a reaction as if what you are guessing is true. You get outraged. How could they? But you're outraged at your guess, not at their actual behavior. The more damage we've had, the more difficulty we've had growing up, the more likely we are to guess motives. Why? What strategy is that? You know, if you're wrong 80% of the time and you're being beaten by your father, that 20% can make a big difference. Better to guess and be wrong. Lay low. Leave. Go somewhere else. Better to do that than to get beat and be surprised. And so jumping to conclusions. Personalization, where you see everything through the grid of you, how it's affecting you. There's so much here that I can't even touch it. All of this to say there are good scientific reasons to not be so confident in what you think. To be more tentative. To start using and meaning language like, I'm not sure, I have this thought that maybe, but I don't know for sure. Biblical reasons, well, we're fallen. Fallen people are self-seeking. You know, if you look at the big letter of love, 1 Corinthians 13, what do we notice about love? It's not self-seeking. Frankly, I think an acid test for your humility is whether you love. Fallen people are self-righteous. We want to be righteous on our own recognizance. We want to be righteous because of what we do. And when someone approaches us and begins to suggest that there might be something wrong with us, we have these automatic defense programs that kick in. And so we justify ourselves. To justify yourselves is to tell a story in which you're not guilty. We conceal. We condemn the other person, right? Counterpunching. We overpower them. We lie. We withdraw. We blame. We punish. To confuse and confuse others. Some people have this super power that I cannot overcome. It's called flooding. If you start to criticize someone who has this superpower, they will start talking and talking and talking and talking, and subjects will change very rapidly. It's like a squid in water shot its ink load in the water. It gets very confusing. In the end, this might go on for 45 minutes. In the end, I can't even remember what I tried to bring up. It is a superpower. I applaud you, but you're full of pride. I probably could have avoided reading all these heavy books by just really believing Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful and desperately sick. Who can know it? Only God can know it, truthfully. But we also have an enemy who's deceptive. He lies, he accuses, he deceives. It's his stock and trade. He creates and sustains human cultures that resonate with our fallenness and keep the wool pulled over our eyes. All right. Humility is much more tentative about what it knows. If you encounter a wise person, you'll encounter someone who will play with their cards out on the table. They'll say, well, I see this, but I also noticed that. I'm not sure how to land on this question, but all the cards are there for you to look at. There's no sense of that hubris of having to have an answer. And really, a very wise person will help you do that instead of handing it to you. People are more persuaded by the ideas in their own head than the ideas in someone else's head, said Blaise Pascal. Here's an example of tentativeness. I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but think so as to have sound judgment. In another place, when Paul was being accused of all sorts of things, he says, I'm conscious of nothing against myself, yet I'm not by this acquitted. But the one who examines me is the Lord. Pride is narcissistic about what it wants. Pride is willful. You may describe yourself as intense. Willful is what it is. My way. It rejects and ignores God's authority. It pursues its own desires. I've spread out my hands all day long to a rebellious people who walk in the way which is not good, following their own thoughts, says God in Isaiah. In the book of Judges, what's repeated again and again is everyone did what was right in his own eyes. This period of time without a king, which is also our modern period. Everyone doing what's right in their own eyes. Who's the arbiter? Self is the arbiter. What's that? As a finite, dependent creature, to put yourself forward as one who decides what's right, what is that? It's pride. Humility is meek. Meek is a term which is used for horses when they were trained and broken. So a war horse is a very scary animal. But if it's meeked, it's under the control of its rider. Powerful, but under control. Someone is in charge. And so I just did a quick sampling of Jesus in John. What I see is that God's will, others' needs, have a controlling influence over his personal desires. Jesus said in teaching them how to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He's oriented toward the will of the Father. How about this? The Son can do nothing of himself unless it's something he sees the Father doing. I can do nothing on my own initiative. I do not receive glory from men. I've come down from heaven not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me. My teaching is not mine, but him who sent me. I've not come of myself. I can do nothing on my own initiative. I've not even come on my own initiative. He sent me. I do not seek my glory. I do not speak on my own initiative. The word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. This is just John. This is meek. Powerful? Absolutely. He can raise the dead. But he's meek. He's under control of his Father. Others' needs have a controlling influence as well. And so we read in Philippians 2, 3 and following, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. Literally, it's kenodoxa, empty glory. Glory is weightiness, hollow glory. How's that? That's empty conceit. But with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Don't merely look out for your own personal interests, but also the interests of others. So you're proud. Our other part of the passage says, God gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. We see this pattern in this letter where Peter says a lot about God's goodness, his grace, the gifts he's given. And it's butted up against almost always his power, his authority, his sovereignty. So he gives grace to the humble, but he's got a mighty hand. He's gracious and he's powerful. So humble yourselves toward God. Disbelief in God's love or power is typical of the proud during suffering. This is why this book, I think, lingers on this idea. When we're suffering, is God good? Does he care? Does he notice? Does he love me? These questions always come up in suffering. This is why I think Peter keeps emphasizing how good God is and how powerful he is. He's good and he's powerful. And you're suffering. If handled well, if you can sort of fight your way to belief in God's goodness and power in the middle of suffering, it will strangle a certain form of pride. Now, I'm not saying when you're suffering, don't complain to God. The Bible teaches us to complain to God. But you notice when someone's complaining to God, they're a creature. they're dependent. It's God they're complaining to. And all of those things, someone can complain and be humble. But when you start judging God, when you put Him in the witness stand and you're condemning Him, you've become a judge. You're proud. There's a difference. God actually initiates this process. Thank God we would never have any success if He didn't initiate this. How does He do it? Through biblical revelation. He reveals Himself. I was noticing in Psalm 19 that God both reveals Himself in nature and He reveals Himself in the Word. And this revelation in 2 Timothy, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. It's profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. So God will challenge us by written revelation. Why do you meditate on Scripture? To be challenged, to be humbled, to shrink in part. Through nature, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There's no speech or language per se, but their voice still goes out into all the world. Romans 1 brings up the same point. You know, I wonder sometimes if we suffer from an outrageous level of pride because we don't spend that much time in nature. Well, both those weren't supposed to come up. Here's a piece of igneous rock lava in Iceland, moss growing up around it, grass. It's just really awesome. Here's some Dr. Seuss mountains in Iceland, with aurora borealis behind it and waterfalls everywhere. And you sit and you contemplate these things. Or if you go to the Black Canyon in Colorado and you look up at the Milky Way sweeping across the skies, how long do you have to sit there before you realize, I am very, very small in space and time? And through existential insights, this may sound like philosophy, but what I mean by existential insights is God reveals things along the way. And He does this in a lot of ways. One of the ways He does this is through conviction. The work of the Spirit is to convict. And when the Spirit convicts you, you're like, oh, I was wrong. I was wrong. No justification. No explanation. Just conviction. And the Spirit, wow, if the Spirit didn't do this, no one would come to Christ. We'd have no hope at all. And I'm putting these three things together because I want to have you look at Deuteronomy chapter 8. He does this through supernatural provision. I was riding home from Cleveland one day. I was supposed to teach a central teaching that night. We hit black ice, fog everywhere, but it was freezing on the road. And I saw a police car with its lights. I went to pump my brakes. I had no friction at all. And I'm pumping my brakes. The cop is standing at his bumper. And I'm like, I'm about to crush this guy. And my van went, and I rolled right by. Honest to God, I looked for handprints. This is a supernatural provision. Through deprivation and suffering, it's really in our losses a lot of times we come to grips with who am I, who is God, and in abundance. But I want to go through this Deuteronomy passage because I think you need to understand how what you're like when God does things. Remember all the way in which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years? That He might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart. Did He need to know? They needed to know. And so He led them so that they could understand their own hearts, whether you keep His commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you understand man does not live by bread alone. Wait a minute, where have I heard this before? Oh, wasn't it Jesus? when he was in the wilderness fasting, when he was very needy, he knew the lesson. He knew the lesson. Wasn't independence, but dependence. Your clothing didn't wear out, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart the Lord your God was disciplining you as a man disciplines his son. Therefore keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and fear him, for the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land. When you've eaten and are satisfied, you'll bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. So all the way in which God has led you that he might humble you. The purpose of all of these activities was to humble so that they could shrink. He humbled you by letting you be hungry so you would shrink. And what happened when they were hungry? They were rebellious. He humbled you by giving you manna. I don't even know I've ever heard anyone except this passage point out that their clothing didn't wear out and their shoes didn't wear out and they didn't get swollen ankles. I might not even notice. Maybe they didn't notice either. But they noticed the manna. And what did they, when they got a supernatural provision, what did they do? They tried to hoard it. Why? I don't know if he's going to give it to me tomorrow. What does that say about their view of God? What does that say about their view of themselves? He won't provide. I need to provide. He tested them that way. How else did he test them? If we go on, he says, when you get into the land that I'm going to give you, when you've eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold multiply and all that you have multiplies because I've done this, then your heart will become proud and you'll forget the Lord your God. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. He fed you manna which your fathers didn't know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who's given you the power to make wealth. It's like that Simpson cartoon where Bart's praying for Thanksgiving. God, we did all this ourselves. You know, you didn't do any of this for us, so thanks for nothing. The irony, of course, is Bart didn't do anything for it. And also through other people. We're supposed to admonish one another day by day so that we won't become hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Sometimes it's positive influence of people trying to address things in our lives. Sometimes it's negative. Psalm 73, he looks at how the wicked are doing very well. They're healthy, they're wealthy, everything's going well for them. He's almost to the point. He said, I almost betrayed your people. I almost said, it's for nothing I followed God. But then he went to the temple and he came to his senses. And then it occurred to him, you are continually with me. That's a plus. What else do I put on my pros and cons list? You hold me by the right hand. Good. You guide me with your counsel. Afterward, you receive me into glory. Who do I have in heaven but you? On earth is none I desire beside you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. What changed? The wicked were still doing wickedly. They were still wealthier and healthier than he was. What changed was his own prideful heart. So other people, negatively or positively. The next time someone irritates you, take a quick glance heavenward and say, what are you up to? Because it's probably humility. Remember, love is patient. Love is kind. It doesn't envy. It doesn't boast. Do you see how many of these things are tied to not being prideful? It's not proud. It's not rude. It's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered. It doesn't keep any record of wrongs. It doesn't rejoice in evil. It rejoices in the truth. I only learned that from a vacation Bible school sing-along. It worked. So God initiates this process, but our job is to notice and to respond. Notice. How do we notice? Well, we notice by getting ourselves out into nature. Actually, this is a therapy God has for stress. 10 minutes in nature will lower your stress level. It's from Him. Hey, here's my gift for your stress. Go stare at a tree for a while. Look up in the sky. Get into the Word, right? If He initiates, then respond to His initiative by getting into the Word, by meditating on Scripture, by getting out into nature, by thinking about Him as you're in abundance and as you're provided for, and even in supernatural ways, and when you're in deprivation, and when other people's bad behavior, other people's good behavior hits you with your behavior. Notice. Respond. Some part of you has to be able to look past the horizontal to what He's up to. This is what noticing is. This is what responding is. And respond. One response is the fear of the Lord. We like to say the fear of the Lord means respect. It means more than that. It means I'm encountering someone who is full of potentially fatal power. It means realizing while God is entirely predictable as to His nature, that doesn't mean there's going to be a good outcome for me. Because in His sovereignty and His goodness, He may permit frightening things to happen. It's like Lewis said in his Chronicles of Narnia, when the kids asked if Aslan was safe, he's like, safe? He's not safe. He's kind. And so the fear of the Lord is, imagine you standing in front of something that's unbelievably awesome. I was standing at the Niagara River, right on the edge where it went over to the falls, and I was just looking at how the swirls and the eddies and the power, it's just like, it was hard to turn away. That's awe. That's fear of the water. Or getting my hands into an electrical box that's like 440 voltage. I had the fear of the electrical box, right? Standing on a roof trying to take someone's antenna off on a pitched slate roof in Clintonville. Trying to figure out how to get back on the ladder because it's easier going up these ladders than down. Fear, awe, right? My full attention was riveted. That's what awe does. Fear of the Lord is your full attention is riveted on Him. Just like Jesus' words show that His full attention was riveted on the Father. This is why when things happen in the horizontal plane and we rivet ourselves on those things, it shows we are worshiping the wrong thing. Fear of circumstances, fear of what the devil might do, is dangerously close to worship. In Isaiah, God says, I'm the one you're to fear. I'm the one you're to dread. But the nice thing about the fear of the Lord is it frees you from all other fears. Submit to His good leadership of you. Haven't you had times in your life when you felt like this is the worst thing I could imagine? Have you had the moment where you've turned to God and said, even though this is out of my control, it's not out of yours. Even though I hate this, I'm going to trust you in this. I know you have something in this. Even if I don't know my entire life what it is, I'm going to trust you. Have you read through the life of Joseph and thought, this is the attitude I want to have? I want to be able to go from my teens to nearly 40 years old and have complete confidence that whatever someone intended for evil, God intended for good. I want to be able to see, to realize, even though I can only see maybe a little of the good God intended, He's doing much, much more because He's God. He's got a very long and a very complex game in play Joseph didn't know much. He knew his family was going to be saved from famine. That's all he knew. He didn't know a nation was going to come out of this. He didn't know a book was going to come out of this. He didn't know a Messiah was going to come out of this. He didn't know we'd be talking about this millennia later. He knew none of this. You could be Joseph. You could decide to trust yourself to God, who does everything right, even things we don't like, and practice gratitude toward God. Boy, there's nothing more common in the Bible than a call to gratitude, and nothing will help you shrink and poke holes in your pride than dwelling on what's good about God. Years ago, I felt like I wasn't that close to God. I decided to study Isaiah because there's a lot of theology in Isaiah. What I discovered was I was full of myself. I had to shrink. When I was struggling with my own self-absorption and shame orientation, I just memorized scripture that had nothing to do with me, that had everything to do with God and what he committed himself to. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd meditate my way through Psalm 73, Psalm 23, Hebrews 13, 5 and 6, Zephaniah 3, 10 and 17. I just would run these things through my mind because they pertain to me, but they have nothing to do with me. I don't have to be anything. This is just who he is. And then I could rejoice. I could fight with him and say, it doesn't seem true to me. But in the end, decide to be loyal to him and practice gratitude toward him. Pride's hard to recognize. It's like carbon monoxide poisoning. See, I can't really see this, I'm colorblind, but you see the redness in his face? Carbon monoxide binds to the molecule that binds oxygen, and you get this cherry red complexion. He died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Pride is like this. What mirror do we look in to see the effect? I think one mirror we can look in is our unwillingness to notice and respond to God's initiatives. Humble yourselves toward one another. We read this first part, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, death on the cross. So one way that we humble ourselves toward each other is we lower ourselves in service to other people. Is there anything beneath you? When you see trash on the floor, do you like, that's not my trash? Is it beneath you to pick up trash? Is it beneath you to talk to this irritating person? Is it beneath you to hang with people who are not lovely? It wasn't beneath Christ. We're altogether unlovely. But he humbled himself and became a servant. This is thinking about and serving other people. Practicing gratitude about and toward others. We give thanks to God always for all of you, constantly mentioning you in our prayers. I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. You want to have a fight? Fight about who's going to give more honor, as opposed to competing and criticizing. Lewis received a lot of letters. He responded to most of the letters he got. One woman was constantly writing him with all of her petty annoyances. In one particular letter, she was complaining about the sins of all the people around her. And he said, "May God's grace give you the necessary humility. Try not to think, much less speak, of their sins. One's own are a much more profitable theme. And if, on consideration, one can find no faults on one's own side, then cry for mercy, for this must be a most dangerous delusion." And rather than seeking glory from others, My favorite verses, really, of the last decade is John 5:44, where Jesus explains to the religious leaders, you know why you don't believe all the miracles I've done? Why you don't believe I'm Messiah? You know why you don't? Because you seek glory from one another. Instead of the glory that comes from the one and only God. Is it wrong for you to want glory? No! It's wrong for you to want it from people. All you man pleasers out there. Start seeking the glory that comes from God. I'll give you a start. Work your way through the Gospel of John. Because Jesus says he doesn't seek glory from man. He urges others not to seek glory from one another. But his full-time job is seeking the glory of God. And in doing this, you're going to find you're not going to be seeking it from others. Confess your faults and failures. One person said this in The Prideful Soul's Guide to Humility. I don't confess my sin because I'm so humble. I do it because it helps me be more humble. Well, that's true. When you have to admit your fault to someone, you shrink. Actually, you just shrink down to size, almost. Let others serve you. So people in your life have examples of faith in God, gratitude, submission, and loving service. Letting them serve you means you look at their example. Part of your gratitude is you notice their example and follow their example. I have a lot of people in my life who serve other people. I serve many more people than I ever would if they weren't in my life. I have people in my life who have great faith in God. I have more faith in God because they're in my life. I let them serve me this way. I let their example not be something to compete with or to be envious of, but something to enjoy and imitate. Through their attentiveness to our expressed needs, I can't tell you how many hours of grief and how much money has been saved by people helping me with my needs. Through the direct challenges, everybody here is defensive. This is a manifestation of pride. If you would get rid of pride, lay down your defenses and try to receive what someone's saying. Make it easy for them to tell you what's bothering them. Thank them for revealing it to you, because telling someone bad news is not easy work. If God can speak through Balaam's ass, he can speak through anyone. God will oppose the proud to exalt the humble. We're on the final stretch here. Everyone who exalts himself, Jesus said, in three different locations, will be humbled, will be humbled. And everyone who humbles himself will be exalted. He's mentioned this when people were looking for social status in Luke 14. He mentions it with the Pharisee and the man in the temple, the Pharisee being self-righteous. He mentions it about people loving praise from other people. This is absolutely will happen. Are there proud people that bother you? God will humble them. God will humble them. You don't even have to. A man's pride will bring him low, but a humble spirit will obtain honor. The fear of man brings a snare, but he who trusts the Lord, see that relationship between trust and humility, will be exalted. Humble yourselves, casting all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Just the last quick point. A lot of anxiety is tied up in pride. There's peace. If you look at Psalm 131, how does this the writer find himself nestled into God taking comfort? Because he's not proud. He's not haughty. He doesn't walk around in his problems. When Jesus calls us to learn of his own humility, he intends to strip us of the pride that keeps us from experiencing rest. This is in your bibliography, I think. I think there's a lot of humility, frankly, in Ajith Fernando's book, A Loving Life. It's an unpacking of 1 Corinthians 13, but it's laced through with a humble response.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.